Welcome, everyone, as always, to our panel today. We will be focusing on how the Trump administration is affecting or changing healthcare in the United States, as well as how investors can and are positioning themselves in the biopharma and healthcare sectors. We've got a panel of experts here with us today from both the medical field and investments, and we're going to go over a ton of stuff. Now, this panel is sponsored by Tama ETFs, who manage several funds, including the HRTS, GLP-1, Obesity and Cardiometabolic ETF. You can check out their page here on Twitter and at Tama ETFs. Now, those of you who have attended our spaces before know that I like to keep the panels wide open. I like to keep the discussion going along. So as we kind of chug through things, all panelists, please feel free to chime in when you've got something more to add to any other speaker's topics. The only request I have is that we stay muted until everyone's done talking. That way we don't get any feedback or overlap. A little bit of a disclaimer here at the top, as we may be discussing individual investments, it's important to note that each of your individual circumstances are different. So you need to make sure that you read about each investment carefully to make sure that it fits your risk and return profile. Also note that nothing in this space should be construed as actionable financial advice or a solicitation to buy or sell any security or derivatives. Always conduct your own research or discuss with your licensed financial advisor before making or taking any given investment. Now, with that out of the way, let's get some introduction for today's panelists, everyone. Starting us off here, we've got him back, Yuri Kojamirian, the CIO of today's sponsor, Tama ETFs. He has over a decade of experience managing UK and global portfolios, and he co-managed the Magity Fund, raising several $1 billion in assets. And in previous panels, I say it every time, Yuri's input has been extremely insightful and much needed to keep me on track. Thanks for coming, as always, Yuri.
Thanks for having us.
Next, we've got Dr. Jason Fung, another repeat guest on our medical-related spaces. Dr. Fung is well-versed and rightfully renowned for his work in disease prevention. He's often called the founder of intermittent fasting. Dr. Fung has prescribed intermittent fasting in low-carb, high, healthy-fat diets for the management for and even sometimes the reversal of type 2 diabetes. He's authored numerous books on disease prevention, such as The Cancer Code, and we're honored to have him, as always, joining us today. Welcome back, Jason.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Next, we've got Dr. Ken Berry, a family physician with a font of knowledge helping patients overcome obesity, insulin resistance, and type 2 diabetes. Focusing on actionable dietary and lifestyle changes, Dr. Berry is dedicated to helping patients take full control of their health and works diligently to cut through misinformation on the topics. Another proponent for healthy living and scientifically supported medicine. We're happy to have you back, Ken. Welcome.
Hey, thanks so much. I'm honored to be back with you again, and I'm honored to be in such great company.
Yeah, I think we're going to have a really good one, Ken. Thanks for coming. Next, we've got Dr. Jesse Morse, a board-certified family and sports medicine physician, and you may know him for his expertise in sports injuries and his work on The Injury Experts. Dr. Morse's treatments combine traditional orthopedic medicine with regenerative medicine, and he's extremely passionate about getting to the root of health issues, exploring effects on the immune systems, as well as from toxins. Excited to have you back again as well. Jesse, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to being here.
And last but not least, we've got Nicholas Holscher, an epidemiologist and administrator at the McCulloch Foundation, where they conduct independent research into public health conditions and policies, seeking to optimize policy for the greater good of the public. Thanks for joining us today, Nicholas. I'm excited to hear your takes on policy today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, as we all know, a lot has changed since we last got together for a medical-related panel. And so I want to start off kind of in the thick of things, kind of looking at, specifically at the top here, Medicaid, function of Medicaid policy, and kind of how investors are positioning themselves for any changes in policy that we may be viewing here in the near future. Now, one thing I wanted to touch on here right at the top with you, Yuri. Now, the healthcare industries, particularly hospitals and pharmaceutical companies, receive significant funding from Medicaid. Now, with budget cuts under discussion, What potential financial, especially market implications, could we see for healthcare providers and investors? Yuri, what are you guys at Tama looking like right here at the top?
Yeah, absolutely. And once again, really happy to be on this panel to talk about, I think it's quite an important topic and probably one of the most interesting parts of the market today, both from a sort of valuation perspective, but in terms of understanding where we're going. A lot of people forget that healthcare is nearly 18% of US GDP. So where healthcare goes, a lot of the times the overall economy goes as well. Look, we ended last year kind of after Donald Trump's election and the nomination of Robert Kennedy Jr. with pretty big kind of valuation uncertainty in the market. A lot of the companies, both across medical devices, the obesity space, they were hit quite hard because there was a view that policy was going to create a lot of uncertainty for these businesses to the future. I'd love to be able to tell you that we've resolved some of that uncertainty. I think that's difficult to say at the moment. And Medicaid is definitely one of those areas as well that has been introduced more recently, but it has always been under the radar in terms of the amount of spending that goes into that particular program. I think overall, what we've seen in terms of kind of retiring some of these risks is we've had RFK Jr.'s kind of Senate nomination conversation. Of course, there were difficult questions that he answered, but he is absolutely a lawyer, so he was able to navigate through those questions quite well. And I think the overall picture from investors came out that he's serious about the overall agenda, which is to try to promote health in the United States. Of course, there are lots of issues with some of his previous views, and they will have an impact on different companies. But the uncertainty kind of lifted a little bit, I would say. And I think this is important for people who are looking at the space to think about. The healthcare sector continues to be one of the most attractively valued in the market today. When I say this, I think it's near a 30-year discount to the S&P 500 in terms of its multiple. And we haven't seen this low a weight of healthcare within the S&P 500 for 24 years or something like that. I mean, these are really staggering stats. So the last time we saw this kind of valuation disconnect was actually previous periods of policy uncertainty around the Affordable Care Act or so-called Obamacare reforms, and actually also around what was called Hillary Care in the 1990s. So the market has already moved to price in a lot of uncertainty. And on top of this, you have this conversation about Medicaid and the idea that this is a vast program of billions of dollars that are being spent, particularly within hospitals and pharmaceuticals as well, and this will have ramifications. I think that the biggest area to really understand is how the money gets spent. And often the companies in the stock market aren't necessarily the ones that are benefiting from that, especially when, like us, you're investing in the devices, the drugs, the therapeutics, effectively the stuff that goes into hospitals, rather than maybe the hospitals being run themselves. And I think those areas are often surprisingly a small percentage of the actual spend that gets spent. Most of the money gets spent on labor and on hospital facilities and a lot of other ancillary services that go into providing care in the United States to a program like Medicaid. And so I think investors probably looking at this are thinking, how is these cuts, which is yet to be determined how exactly these budget savings are going to be implemented, get played through the system. Now, unfortunately, also, you could get a hit on all of these devices and drugs that are going into this program because they're easier to maybe cut than it is to cut labor or focusing on some of these other services costs. But it's still a lot of uncertainty about exactly how some of these cuts will be implemented. The question, I think, on everyone's minds, and this goes more broadly to government spending, is there actually unnecessary or wasteful spend that could be cut? And that inevitably doesn't really have an impact on some of these companies providing innovation. And I think the final thing is, as investors, what we try to focus on the most, and it always kind of makes me sleep at night comfortably investing in the healthcare sector, is if you focus on innovation and actually bringing real change to patients at the end of the day, more likely or not, your company will be able to charge a fair price and will likely be unscathed from any sort of budget cuts. Because no matter what government is in place, no matter what the budget is, there will be always room, especially in the United States, to pay for innovation. So that's broadly, and I know it's quite high level, but I think for our audience, it's a good way to think about how we see the healthcare space. Generational valuation opportunity, a lot of really interesting stuff going on policy, and it'll be, you know, still very much uncertainty unretired, and the focus on innovation, which is important to what we do at Tema.
That was a beautiful primer, Yuri. Thank you. And I do want to touch a little bit more on that notion of budget cuts before we get to kind of the greater topics at hand. Now, as mentioned, the Trump administration and House Republicans are considering Medicaid budget cuts ranging from quoted $1.5 to $2.5 trillion with the intention of funding tax reductions and border security. Now, opponents, including Republican Representatives Don Bacon and Brian Fitzpatrick, warn that drastic cuts could compromise healthcare quality and availability. So I'm curious, from the point of view of providers, I'll kick this one to the whole panel, starting with Dr. Fun. What impacts could these cuts have on healthcare access for low-income populations and for hospital funding at large?
Well, I think it's difficult because what they're trying to do is obviously not cut services, but just cut a lot of the waste. I mean, I'm not sure if you've seen some of the graphs of the growth in spending in healthcare and they compare, say, the growth in physician billings versus administration. And, you know, the administrative part of it is like 10 times the growth, right? So a lot of the growth in the cost has come from administration, as opposed to your doctor, your physiotherapist, and so on. So that's what they're trying, like, that's the goal, is to try and cut a lot of that part out. So hopefully that the low-income person is not going to notice a decrease in spend. I mean, it's actually not any different than, say, for higher education, where you see that the number of professors' salaries hasn't really gone up. It's all administration. So you're just layering on these people that basically are not frontline people, right? So you have frontline healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, physiotherapists, and really you don't want to be cutting those people. What you want to do is try and cut all the sort of administration, like the red tape, right? Like there's just layers and layers and layers of red tape. Honestly, every other country looks at the United States and go, you guys spend more per person, per capita on your healthcare, but get way less. And obviously it's because you're just spending it on, you know, paper pushers and stuff. Like I've worked in both the US healthcare system and the Canadian healthcare system, and there's just reams of paperwork that you have to go through. It's just sucks out all your time. So, you know, if you're spending all your time and money on paperwork, then you're not delivering care. Like it's so far out of line. And I think that's where, you know, and of course what happens is that those paper pushers like to create more paper so that there's more paper to be pushed, which makes their jobs look so much more important. And before you know it, there's this big mountain of paper to do any, you know, to put a Band-Aid on sort of thing, right? So that's the real problem, is that that's where you're trying to cut. Like, is there going to be some sort of collateral damage and services and so on? Probably, hopefully not, but probably. But on the other hand, it's not sustainable the way things are, because there's just so much other stuff. I mean, it goes the same for prescription costs. So you look at the costs of medications in the United States, and they're, again, like five times the cost of the same medication in, say, Canada, and like 30 times the cost in India. So I have Indian patients that go back to India because they're like, well, I can go back to India, and the amount of money I save on medication pays for that trip. And then I get to visit my family and have a little vacation. So it's ridiculous. And it's actually the same medication. Like it's produced under license by the Indian company. It just costs a few bucks opposed to a few thousand bucks. So essentially the American public is getting ripped off, like, in a huge manner. And it's not by the nurses and doctors and so on. That's been the same since the 60s. It's the bureaucracy that's grown on top of it that's basically trying to sustain itself at the public trough.
So let's real quick take a short detour to that topic of drug pricing. Obviously, it's no mystery, as Dr. Fung just said, that the cost of medicine in the United States is pretty, it's pretty up there compared to the rest of the developed world. Now, the notion here, and RFK has discussed this at length, that Big Pharma focuses much more on profitability than on public health as a whole. And we saw that very clearly with the pricing of insulin, for example, prior to the caps that were instituted under the Biden administration. Now, Dr. Ken, I'd love your take here. Do we still kind of expect to see these aggressive drug pricing reforms under RFK, especially in cases where drugs for patients are relatively cheap to develop, but have crazy markups, just like we had seen historically with insulin?
Well, we would certainly hope so. I love the great points Dr. Fung just made, and I'd like to kind of tie my thoughts on that in with this question. So medicine, the practice of medicine, comes down to two people, the patient and the doctor. That's how it began, and that's how we've got to return to that, at least to a very large degree, because currently in an exam room, when there's a doctor and a patient, there are also thousands of invisible people present in that exam room that should not be there at all. And so there are all these corporations, there are all these administrators, all these rent seekers and sharecroppers who have seen this interaction between a doctor and a patient and how powerful it is. And they look at that not as a beautiful thing that two humans could be doing together. They look at that as a profit center. And they're like, ooh, I can sharecrop just a little bit of the profit out of that, or I can rent sink just a little bit of that profit. And then when I compound that, when I scale that up, that's going to turn into a multi-million dollar or billion dollar business for me. And part of the blame is squarely on doctors for ever allowing that to happen. But what we have to realize now is we've went so far down the road of turning the doctor-patient relationship into this thing that needs to be administrated and this thing that needs to have lots of regulations on it. We've went so far down that road for decades now that this is first of all, a huge ship, and it's went many, many miles in the wrong direction. So turning around a big ship, there's lots of analogies about that. And then actually reversing course and going back to where we should be, also analogies about that. And it's because those things are so hard to do and they so rarely happen. And that's where we're at. And so Dr. Fung's point to the recent chart that's been all over X about how much a doctor actually charges in that doctor-patient relationship versus what the administrative fees are for that beautiful, almost sacred happening when a doctor and a patient seek each other out. It's absurd, and it's awful what's happening. The doctor is a tiny percentage of the cost of healthcare. If you look at this thing globally, he's maybe 5% of the cost. 95% of the cost is for all the pharmaceutical companies, all the healthcare administrators, all of the government officials who now have a cushy $200K a year job because they're somehow administering or regulating this what should be a pristine spiritual interaction between a doctor and a patient. Everybody's getting their little piece of the pie off that. Now, do I have high hopes that this will be corrected under RFK? I'm very hopeful. What do I think is going to happen? Well, the federal government is involved in this, and literally hundreds of billions of dollars of profit for the big pharmaceutical companies who all have a pasture full of lobbyists that they can send out. We've got congressmen and senators who in many cases have been compromised, who that's who we have to trust to vote this stuff through. some of this can be done with executive order when it comes to how the executive branch of the federal government is run in the United States. A lot of it can be done with executive order, but most of this, especially the price cutting, ultimately is going to have to be codified in the law by the Senate and Congress, or it's just going to be a flash in the pan. We'll have a big to-do here for the next 4 years, and then a new administration will be in, and everything will go right back to the way it was. That's my fear, because the federal government is like a fully automatic machine gun. It's a powerful weapon and a powerful tool. You can use it for good, or it can destroy everything you love. And so that's my fear, is that as long as the federal government and all the lobbyists from Big Food and Big Pharma have their teeth in this pie, it's going to be very difficult to return it to this beautiful interaction between a doctor and a patient that it initially started as, and hopefully one day will return to. Here in Tennessee, we have TennCare. That's our version of Medicaid. And many doctors don't even take it because the doctor gets paid less than minimum wage for their part of it, while all the PBMs and the big pharma and everybody else gets a much bigger lion's share of the money that changes hands. I have great hopes, and I'm working fervently here in Tennessee. And then I'm happy to also work at the federal level if anybody thinks that my voice can sway and do any good. Just like Granny Berry used to say, hope for the best and prepare for the worst. And I think that's where we're at in many different aspects of our life here in the United States currently. I hope for the best, but I hope everybody is preparing for the worst and also trying to work to make the best at least closer to reality than our current less than ideal reality is.
She sounds like a wise woman, Dr. Ken. I think I would agree with that sentiment. So I do want to touch on this a little bit, on this topic of healthcare pricing, as it were. Now, obviously, Medicare and Medicaid provide a pretty extensive service to lower income population in the United States. And one thing I wanted to touch on was the notion of privatization. President Trump has indicated a desire to privatize both Medicare and Medicaid. And so I'm curious, if we have this notion where pharmaceutical companies tend to, again, prioritize profit over benefit to the consumer, to the patient, what sort of impact could we have if Medicare and Medicaid become more privatized in aspects of cost of medicine, accessibility, and patient outcomes? Nicholas, could you kind of give us your point of view here from a policy perspective? Based on that notion that seems to be kind of agreed upon, that medication's already pretty inflated, businesses kind of focusing on that profitability, would privatization of these two entities really be that great of an idea?
So the problem with privatization or further privatization of these pharmaceuticals, including vaccines, might not be the best idea in the long term. And I say that because when we have unsafe products on the market and we have and these companies have not much incentive to create the most safe product they can create, we will see increased burden on the healthcare system due to increases in diseases. And so what I mean by that is, so over 80% of the U.S. population did receive at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. And since this campaign, we have seen huge increases, surges in extremely expensive insurance claims due to these bad health syndromes that are now popping up at increased rates. And so what I mean by that, so with the COVID-19 vaccines as an example, so the vast majority of the population took it.
So let's do try to stay on topic a little in that term of privatization, Medicaid, and Medicare. We will touch a little bit on perception of what you're discussing a little later on, but for now I want to stay right on that Medicaid topic.
Right, right. Right. Okay. Yeah. So, privatization. I would say it's not the greatest idea. I think there should be quite the oversight over pharmaceutical testing and creation. And I'm not sure if that would be possible if all of this became more privatized.
I think well said. Does anyone have anything to add to what Nicholas said? Maybe Dr. Jesse?
Yes, please. Thank you. Unfortunately, we've seen a dramatic shift over the past 10, 15, 20 years in privatization of just American healthcare. And we've seen the now ramifications and results of that. The obesity rate is skyrocketing. Overall, everybody is really, really unhealthy. Diabetes is very prevalent. Metabolic syndrome, cancer is through the roof. And a lot of this is because we're trying to make things more expensive. So the barrier to entry is much harder. The issues with making premiums elevated basically is counterproductive. So a lot of the patients don't have the money to basically go see their doctor. Or like myself, I don't even take insurance because I was sick of all the red tape the insurance was offering and all the treatments that I was suggesting they weren't willing to pay for. So it was like, I'm chasing my tail trying to help patients and basically I was performing a charity. So the issue when you make something private is at the end of the day, they're looking for profit. And that's essentially what's happened. When you, I have an MBA and when I looked at my breakdown of costs for primary care, it costs about 30% to provide a service. The problem is Medicaid actually only pays 22%. So you're actually paying the patient to see them. So when you make that private, yes, you will make more money, but where's that money coming from? And are they getting appropriate services? That's why when you go into a hospital and they charge you, $300 or $500 for a Tylenol, it's because they're only paying, $50 for that Tylenol, and that's where they have to make their money. If you have predominantly Medicaid patients, they only pay 31 to 33%. So if you're providing a 30% service, you're making 1 to 3% on that entire transaction. And not only that, they are paying 6 to 9 months later. So that hospital has to eat that bill for 6 to 9 months for that service, but they still have to pay all their meds. They still have to pay for all their providers. Whereas if you're seeing like a Blue Cross or any of the privates, they usually have a contract between 40 and probably 45% of that total bill. So they're, they get a $10,000 bill. They probably end up paying about $4,500 to the hospital. That other $5,500 gets written off. So that's why they end up having to jack up all the hospital bills because they're not making half or less than half of that. So it ends up being counterproductive. The average hospital stay for an ICU per night is over $10,000 to $15,000. Like, it's crazy. And everything has just got more and more expensive. You translate that to outpatient, which is for the majority of us, majority of patients are not in the hospital. They end up not paying for services. And when the primary issue is now the doctors are making 30, 40% of what they used to make. So now instead of seeing 20 patients a day and spending appropriate time with the patients, they have to see 30 to 40 to make the same amount of money. So what happens is you end up having 7 to 10 minutes with your patient. The doctor's running around like a chicken with his head cut off. And insurance is denying everything. So now you have your staff trying to get them cleared for XYZ med, and no one has time for that. The insurance ends up winning because that medicine is never get covered because they don't have time to clear it. So it becomes very challenging when you privatize things. But with a population of our size, it's also very challenging to make it completely social. Socialized medicine works in Canada because they have 10% of our population, or maybe a little bit more than that. But I have many Canadian patients that fly down to me in Miami because they can't get what they want because they have to wait 6 to 9 months to get it. So there are significant issues with socialized medicine as well. Although, yes, you technically have that medicine covered under your taxes. At the same time, it might not be when you want it. It might not be exactly what you want. But yes, it will get covered. So there's a lot to unravel. And I don't think there's an easy solution. I think big pharma and big insurance have caused a ton of issues in the American healthcare system. And if you look at the follow the money, they're the only ones getting paid. everyone else is doing the work and they're just cashing in left and right, unfortunately. And just, you know, look at their stock prices, look at everything else, look at how much money their executives make. But unfortunately, the patients are getting sicker and the doctors are starting to burn out because there's too many patients and there's not too much paperwork. And there's just not, you know, it's just become overwhelming.
Thank you, Jesse. Now, I do want to touch real quick, Yuri, on how drug reform might affect the pharmaceutical sector of equities. Is there any cause for concern here among pharma investors? And how is Tama planning to navigate any major changes that might affect the GLP-1 ETF, for instance?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a really interesting question. And I think what the other panelists have highlighted is absolutely true, right? Drug prices are much higher in the United States than they are everywhere else in the world. The pharma companies will tell you that is because America effectively is the center of development of new pharmaceutical agents. It has the most vibrant biotechnology industry and some of the largest pharmaceutical companies invest the most in research and development. And as we all know, it's very, very expensive to develop a medicine. To take it all the way from discovery to action on the market can take sometimes 10 years. And all of that time, you're earning no revenues from this drug. And in many ways, the system is designed to create some sort of patent protection and ability to price up. Now, of course, there are massive inefficiencies in how the system works at the end. I think someone made a really good point, which is uniquely really in the US is a system where effectively the patient, the doctor, or the healthcare provider, let's call it, and the payer are all different entities. And that can be quite difficult to sort of create the right incentives for. So you have this situation where basically drug prices are a hot, let's call it political potato, right? In many ways, they are often the focus of a lot of politicians' negotiations. They are very emotive as well, partly because pharmaceutical is such a big industry in the US, both on the kind of employment side, but also on patients' lives being affected. I think broadly, where we sit today from the pharmaceutical industry's perspective, it's actually a pretty interesting environment. We had the passage of what's called the Inflation Reduction Act back in 2022. And as many of you know, there was a provision within that allowed Medicare to negotiate drug prices directly. So remember, really, the government has power probably over the government programs, which is Medicare for the elderly and Medicaid for those who are less fortunate. And those programs, that's where the question marks arise. Why should those programs be paying such high prices for drug prices when they spend so much with these pharmaceutical companies? Everywhere else in the world, if you think about the United Kingdom or Germany, drug prices negotiate directly with the government and therefore are much lower. And so Congress passes this provision to the Inflation Reduction Act with a focus on allowing a mechanism for Medicare for the first time ever really to negotiate prices directly with pharmaceutical companies. This mechanism is very negative for the industry, but very surprisingly, and as the stock market works in strange ways, it's actually a relief for the industry. Because before, what existed was a very uncertain situation. The government was always interfering in different ways to push drug prices down. And so therefore, there was a lot of uncertainty. And as we all know, the market hates uncertainty. With the provision of IRA, it's almost the same thing as happened with the provision of the Affordable Care Act. Many of you will remember what managed care companies looked like before the Affordable Care Act came in. There was so much uncertainty about how this was going to look. And the relief from the fact that we actually knew where the rules were was helpful to both companies in terms of their planning horizons and understanding how to adjust their investments and make their allocations of capital, but also for everyone involved, the buyers of these pharmaceuticals, the patients in the end as well. We've had the first round of drug negotiations under Medicare happened last year. And the discounts, you know, we're talking about substantial ones. They're ranging anywhere between 40 to up to 60-70% discounts were negotiated for this particular segment. Now remember, private insurance is not included in this. This is really under Medicare. But that was very much in line with what the market was thinking. So I think overall, the picture is actually one of a lot of stability, right? We're sitting here in 2025, and we kind of know how this process is going to work now. Every year, the government will publish a list of drugs that are going to get focus, and I think it's in the 2026 list or the 2025 list, we've included the weight loss drugs, for example. So we already know that these prices are going to get negotiated down for this particular program. And so as pharmaceutical and biotechnology investors, this is a little bit of a relief. And also the companies we speak to, they have allocated all of their spending accordingly. They know where these things are going to be laid out. And there are, of course, parts of the system that they're going to play. Like, for example, negotiations really focus primarily on small molecules and leave out some of the biological, where a lot of the innovation is happening. There's a lot of debate actually going on. What is a small molecule and where do you make the cutoff? And broadly, though, what I'm trying to say is that there's a situation where we have some stability actually for the pharmaceutical companies, and most importantly, lack of uncertainty. And that can lead to a rebuilding of confidence within the healthcare, that part of the healthcare sector. Of course, this is still going to be a political agenda. Of course, there's still the private payer market, which is currently a murky system of negotiations. I think that's fair to say. There are entities that are middlemen, or called that by others, which are called pharmacy benefit managers, owned often by the same insurance companies. And the system effectively suffers from this economic inefficiency, which is that what I said, it's one of the most unique systems where the payer, the patient, and the provider are all different entities, and that can lead to some perverse incentives. But at least the Medicare part has actually relieved uncertainty, and that is a big part of the government because that's the spend that they can directly control. Now, they are probably going to focus on regulation of the private side, partly, I believe, to focus on weeding out some of these middlemen. And a lot of it is really just making profit on negotiating better price discounts from pharmaceutical companies. And I go back to all the time when people ask me about this, and clients, investors, what's the best way to avoid all this? Well, focus on companies that are actually delivering innovation. If you're delivering innovation, you're helping patient outcomes in the end, and that should be rewarded in the current system that we have, instead of focusing on maybe the middlemen or the companies that are just copying others in this sense.
Thank you, Yuri. I don't think anybody could have answered that question any better. That was very deep and insightful, Yuri. Thank you. So I want to touch a little bit here, and we'll kick this one around the panel as well, on the HHS following Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s confirmation into that role. RFK Jr. has called for what he calls radical transparency, urging complete openness in government health agencies and discouraging FOIA requests by proactively releasing internal information. So my question here, from a public point of view, how do you balance transparency with the need to prevent misinformation in public health? Dr. Fung, I'd love to hear your take here.
Yeah, I think that, transparency is the, hopefully what prevents misinformation, right? If you let everybody see what's going on, then nobody has to guess. And that's where a lot of misinformation comes in, by people's attempts to sort of hide the truth or, cover up certain aspects of this thing. And the reason that so many people, including myself, are sort of optimistic with RFK Jr. is precisely that he's an outsider in the whole healthcare business, so that he's able to sort of see through a lot of these cozy relationships and so on. I mean, you see this everywhere. Like, there's tons and tons of conflicts of interest in medicine. So you can start sort of all the way at the top, right? So you have people, all those senators who are trying to sort of browbeat him, and then you see that they had received millions of dollars of lobbyist funds, right? So it's like, okay, well, that's not in the public interest, right? Like, I didn't vote for them to get millions of dollars. And then you see the way that the pharmaceutical representatives, represent drugs, how they sponsor the meetings. So if you go to the American College of Cardiology, there's millions and millions of dollars of advertising to the doctors, so everything's got a conflict of interest. in there, and it's not in the public, you know, that doesn't benefit the public. It benefits the senators, it benefits the healthcare industry, it benefits the, you know, doctors get free meals and free entertainment and all that. I mean, that all came out a lot in the opioid crisis. You saw exactly how much money was being spent, you know, like, you know, strip clubs and stuff for doctors. It was like ridiculous. The whole thing was ridiculous. So this sort of openness and transparency is something we've never had. The lobbying, you know, that's a uniquely sort of American thing. We don't have lobbyists in most other countries. Canada doesn't have healthcare lobbyists, so it's not a profession that you can be a lobbyist. But again, that's just a manner of funneling money from the industry, not to the patient, but to the, you know, to the politicians or to other people. You want money to go to patient care, right? That's how you get the most bang for your buck. It's not through paying off senators, paying off pharmaceuticals, paying off all that. So that sort of openness and transparency is hopefully how you get rid of misinformation. I mean, you saw this, of course, in COVID, where there's a massive attempt to discredit one side of the argument. And when you don't have that transparency, what you get is a completely one-sided argument that leads you basically into making all kinds of mistakes, like, you know, shutting down all the schools. That was a huge mistake. Why? Because you shut down the transparency. And that's where RFK Jr. is, I think, absolutely right, in that that's really what we need. If people see that, hey, how many millions are going to the senators? How many millions are going to budgets like, you know, drug talks for doctors? Like, it's basically an open secret that if I wanted to, I could go get taken out every week to the fanciest restaurant by some drug company, right? It's not even difficult, right? Anybody can do it. I just don't do it because I think it's unethical. But lots of doctors do. And we're not talking about going to like a $20 meal. We're talking about like a $200 meal. I could go every single week if I wanted to. Well, that's not money that's helping anybody. That's money that's advertising a drug to a doctor who then goes back and prescribes that drug to his patient. Not because it's a great drug, it's because he's been brainwashed into thinking it's a great drug. So, you know, you start opening the doors on that. And it's like, you know, and that's crazy, because that's the kind of bribery that's not even available in any other profession. Like, you can't do that in other professions. Like, you can't decide, oh, I'm going to take all the policemen in my city out. Like, that's bribery, right? They can't do that. So this sort of openness and transparency, I think, is exactly what's needed. And when you have an insider who's taken so much money from the industry, you know, has been in the system, they're simply not able to do it because they're so conflicted themselves. So that's where I'm actually quite hopeful that things will, you know, at least this will hopefully be a start. I'm actually quite, I think there's a step in the right direction, and hopefully it doesn't get shut down by all the sort of vested interests.
Thank you, Dr. Fung. Yuri actually brought my attention to something called Open Payments Data, CMS.gov, where they collect and publish information about those financial relationships between providers, covered recipients, and they require all doctors and professionals to disclose in its entirety. Yuri, is that something you foresee being more and more leaned upon as we push for more transparency?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. When I first came across that page, we use it a little bit for research because, you know, we're really trying to avoid the companies that do this egregiously. I mean, of course, the industry is notorious for sponsoring conferences and all this kind of stuff, and that's all get bundled into there with the strip clubs. I think the site is interesting, though. I'm just looking at it now. The data may have stopped. They may have stopped disclosure. It looks like the latest date is December 23. So that's quite a long time ago, but still very, very useful. You can actually put in any healthcare provider in the US and see all of their financial disclosure, I think, above a certain minimum amount. But yeah, I think broadly, transparency is a good thing, but it's very, very important that data and information can often be misinterpreted. So it's important that it's sort of done in these kinds of databases that's searchable and easy to understand, and for people to make their own kind of judgments on these things, because sometimes data doesn't really have a talk track, which can be a good thing or a bad thing.
Fair enough. Yeah, I'm someone who, you know, very, very supportive of that notion of transparency, especially in costs, because as we've discussed at length already today, medicine gets very out of hand very fast for a huge portion of the U.S. population. Now, one thing go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to have one more thing on the Medicaid privatization discussion. I was looking at some really interesting papers, because that is a big point of debate. Just so everyone's aware, the privatization is really of just the provider. So essentially an insurance company will take over running the whole sort of claims, payments, all of those things to healthcare providers. There was a really interesting case study that was done in 2007 in Texas, where there was a change from being a pay for a service. So basically the government paying and not having it outsourced to an insurance company, a private insurance company. And what they found was, lo and behold, the amount of care to patients in the Medicaid program went up in terms of more drugs being prescribed, more tests being done, but obviously the cost also went up. And I think that's the big thing that we're talking about here in terms of these incentives. We're thinking, we have to appreciate that more is helpful to patients, but at the end of the day, it's also much more cost to the government. So it was an interesting finding from that kind of almost natural experiment, as they call them in economics.
Ken, I see your hand. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. I just wanted to speak about the transparency debate issue. Medicine likes to claim that it's both a science and an art. And I think if properly practiced, that's indeed true. We all should implicitly understand that science, in order to help the most people, must be completely transparent. So as this whole healthcare debate goes forward with this new administration, we all need to be particularly watchful. If anybody tries to claim that, we really shouldn't release this to the public, we've got to keep this private, this is proprietary, that's bullshit. There is no world in which science for the greater good can be transparent. We saw recently in the news where a specific drug vaccine manufacturer, they wanted to be transparent, but they just wanted to wait 50 or 75 years before they released that data. That kind of stuff has got to stop immediately. And I hope that's one of the things this new administration does here in the United States. All research, if there's $1 of public money, AKA taxpayer money, that funded that, then all of the information, including all the supplemental data, even the raw data, must be public so that every doctor, every other researcher can see into that research, see how they performed it, see if it was done properly, and then also say, okay, well, what can I take from this research study? Because I'm not just having to read the conclusion. I can actually look at the raw data and see if these guys did this correctly. Now, obviously, patient data needs to be private. Nobody needs to know the patient's name, social security number, date of birth, or any identifying information. Of course, that should be private. That should be protected. I'm talking about the data that does not reveal anybody's identity. That has to be public. And so I think what you're going to see is, as this administration moves forward and they start to say, hey, this needs to be transparent, you're going to see kickback from basically Big Pharma saying, oh, no, we can't release that information because either A, people wouldn't understand, or B, it might lead to confusion. This is a classic argumentative technique when you don't want there to be transparency. And I think everybody, every common sense person understands, oh, okay, yeah, you've got something to hide. But like I said earlier, when you've got hundreds of lobbyists that are at your beck and call, and you can send them out to every congressman and every senator and take them out for a $200 steak dinner, and then maybe do some other stuff, you know, behind the scenes that's not so obvious, they're going to immediately start to say, well, yeah, we probably should keep this, you know, confidential, or at least wait 20 years to put it out. Anytime you guys hear that, that's a huge red flag that there's obfuscation going on. There's more than meets the eye. And we've got that kind of stuff has to stop, or medicine will continue to be hijacked. It'll continue to be the messy morass that it currently is. And it'll keep getting more expensive, and patients will keep suffering.
Thank you, Ken. Dr. Fung, you had something to add there as well.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I completely agree with Ken's points here. It's all got to stop. But everyone has to realize that the dividends are going to be paid out to the American public. Right, when you don't have money going into all these other, you know, things like trying to buy influence and trying to hide data so that you can't see the side effects, right? That was the 75 years. That was, so I don't know why nobody kicked up a big fuss about it, because it was like, you know, people demanded to see the data for the vaccine harms and or whatever, and they said, oh, we'll give it in 75 years, and that's the FDA. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, it should be available like today, like searchable by everybody. And those dividends, like the public has to demand it. I mean, other, because that's who's getting screwed right now by that. And I think the open payments thing, it's a step in the right direction when they did that a few years ago, but some of the payments are huge, like hundreds of thousands of dollars to doctors directly. And that's not even including the fact that you can actually hide a ton of that. Because if you ever look at that payment data, a lot of it is put into like things like, you know, research costs or something like that. And that's where you bundle your research meeting into like, oh, we met at the strip club sort of thing, right? So there's easy, easy ways to hide all that information. And, you know, I always thought, why would you just want disclosure? Like, disclosure isn't enough. Like, it should be made like illegal. You should just cut it all out and make it all, you know, this is where your costs are, it has to be disclosed. And then that's like so much money that could go to the public, you know, health, right? And that's who's getting screwed by it all.
Nicholas, see your hand, something to add as well?
Yeah, I completely agree with both of those points made, that transparency is absolutely key. And what the HHS is actively doing right now is actually removing most of the employees, or the employees that they suspect have a major conflicts of interest. And so what we're going to see in the next few years here is much more transparency regarding the data, and much less bias in interpreting the data. And so I think all of this is going to be publicly revealed soon. But one thing that the HHS is moving to is they're changing from infectious diseases. Basically, they were only focusing on, vast majority of funding was going to infectious disease. Now it's going to be going to chronic disease, of which over 60% of Americans do have at least one chronic disease. And we also, now we've seen people like Trump and many people now in the administration talking about the autism rate skyrocketing, you know, up 317% since 2000. And now 1 in 36 kids have autism. So they're going to be investigating these causes transparently. And we also have to remember that 90% of America's $4.5 trillion in annual healthcare expenditures are for people with chronic health conditions. So it's absolutely key that this new investigation into chronic disease is undertaken and is transparent. And I think it's going to make a major difference in the health of America and reduce these massive expenditures.
Thank you, Nicholas. Jesse, did you have anything to add on the transparency topic?
I think transparency is vital. Without it, we're going to just continue down this current road that we have been going down on. And, you know, the issue with every facet of American healthcare is that at the end of the day, this is about getting Medicare, Medicaid, and eventually the pharmaceutical companies to essentially pay for the drugs. similar to the vaccine schedule, and this is why this is a little controversial, is that, you know, back in 30, 40 years ago, there were only a couple different vaccines that were available. What you have to understand about the vaccine schedule is once a vaccine is placed on that schedule, that pharmaceutical company has two things going for them. One, they cannot be sued ever for that vaccine, regardless of the side effects. Two, they have an open check, a blank check for every single person that has received that vaccine indefinitely. So why would you not want to get a vaccine if you were looking for a for-profit institution? That is a no-brainer. The problem is you're not looking at that from a medicine perspective. That's great from a financial perspective, but what if all of those vaccines or meds or whatever it is, why do the vaccines get the exception of not being able to be sued, not having to have the same health and security and safety data as some of these other meds? Why does it take meds 5, 10, 15 years before they can come to market, whereas vaccines don't have the same scrutiny and can get exceptions? And then once it's on there, good luck getting it off. So that's part of the problem, is that you have this lack of transparency. And people can have issues with it, and there's nothing they can do about it because there's no one to be held accountable. So until you can hold someone accountable for their actions, then it doesn't matter. And these big pharmaceutical companies, and into now you can add big food, they've added all these things that have significantly compromised their health, and they're not telling us about it. You know, rarely do they have to even advertise what is on a label or what is on our food label, and people starting to read the food labels. But when you start adding transparency, you know, I remember seeing a label years ago, you know, last year, year before, I think it was in a different country, that basically showed, hey, this causes cancer. It was on a product that you can buy on the shelf. I'm pretty sure when people see that, they're probably not going to buy that product. We don't have that same stuff. And you've probably seen the same stuff for food comparison, America versus UK or whatever, where the food is completely different. That's all about transparency. Why is it any different for healthcare? Why is American healthcare going down in terms of longevity, but the cost is significantly higher than anywhere else in the world? When you look at these questions, you know, that's the biggest problem, in my opinion. And there's lack of transparency, and there's lack of people holding people accountable.
Well said, Jesse. I want to touch on the topic of regulations and how they may hinder or promote innovation in the sector. Before we let Yuri go today, Yuri, could you touch a little bit on what kind of deregulation might be on the horizon and how that'll affect innovation from biotech companies in the space, and what you guys over at Tamar are watching in that regard?
Oh, that's a really interesting topic, and I think very, very important, because I guess it's the one sort of, in a way, silver lining in many of the discussions, because in many ways what's going on is there's a lot of uncertainty for the healthcare sector in terms of where these policies go. There are budget cuts to Medicaid. All these things can be seen as negative for the healthcare sector. I think one of the positives is potentially a burst of innovation. And that burst of innovation could come from deregulation. As we know, it's very, very important to focus on drug safety at the FDA and to run the proper clinical trials. But there are also a lot of extra bits of regulation that are in a way holding back innovation coming to the market, and could be very, very positive if it's lifted for the market. Counterbalancing this a little bit is potential cuts at the agencies that make these approvals. That could slow things down. I think one of the counterintuitive things in many ways is approvals of new things. They're sort of a function really of number of people employed. Whether they're efficient or inefficient is kind of irrelevant. We've already seen those cuts. They're mostly focused a little bit on the medical device space rather than the actual drugs themselves. And what I'm encouraged of is kind of a drive by the current administration to focus on deregulation as a means of driving innovation. And how this gets implemented will be really interesting to see. But it's a real commitment. I know he's not part of the Department of Government Efficiency anymore, but the original number two next to Elon Musk was Vivek Ramaswamy, and his you know, he's a biotech billionaire. You know, he made his money through biotechnology, and he was very much adamant that the key focus should be on deregulating places like the FDA so that more innovation can reach patients. And remember, this innovation, as long as it's done safely and properly, has the potential to help a lot of patients and also save healthcare systems a lot of costs. If you look at the GLP-1 drug space, you know, there's lots of debate about it, whether it's the right approach or not. But in theory, and there are estimates now from various independent economic research agencies and economic research houses that suggest that it could save the U.S. healthcare system, I mean, billions, by preventing a lot of the major cardiovascular events, kidney disease, liver disease, all of these other things. And these drugs have been shown in clinical trials to work in those areas. And it'll be interesting to see how all of this plays out. But we're really much hoping that that this will be the counterbalancing force for a lot of this. And again, helping those innovative companies push forward, which is what we're investing in.
Thank you, Yuri. Now, I know you had to get going in a few minutes here. So if you could, here at the tail end, let our listeners know where they can learn more about how Tama's doing their investments in the healthcare sector. And as well, to those listening today, I've pinned at the top here, right at the top of the panel, one of the resources that Tama provides. They write a lot about the sectors they invest in. And this one is Tama's 2025 Healthcare Outlook. It's pinned at the top. Definitely check that out. I learn a lot from reading the publications on Tama's website.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anyone who's interested, look, we have three funds in the space. We're very invested. There are three ETFs. The one we mentioned here was the HRTS ETF that's focused on the GLP-1 obesity and cardiometabolic space. Now, it's not just about weight loss drugs. It's about all of the other areas associated with cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and any other metabolic disorders. And we pick these areas because they're the most pressing therapeutic areas out there. You know, the ones that have the most unmet medical need, they're largest in terms of helping patient populations, where there's a ton of innovation and breakthroughs going on that hopefully will help patients in the years to come. For anyone who's really interested, you can head to our website, www.temaetfs.com. And under the insights page, there's loads of articles we've written. We just did one on AI and drug discovery and just drug development in general. We have our healthcare outlook piece for 2025, the areas that we're kind of watching and we're interested in. But there's a lot of analysis there, trying to break through the noise, if you will, of a lot of this uncertainty. We think that if you look past over the last, you know, 20, 30 years, the healthcare sector has been one of the best performing, especially if you look at the more innovative parts like biotechnology. It used to rival technology and still does as one of the key sources of outperformance in the market. And it's just been left behind over the last couple of years, which creates the opportunity. If this innovation continues and say it's accelerated by some of the deregulation that happens, we think this is one of the most interesting buying opportunities people will see in their lifetime in this space. And so, yeah, you can learn more about it. And as Nicholas said at the beginning, definitely do your own work and research and look at the funds and consult your financial advisor to make those decisions. And if you're interested in reading more and you want to reach out, feel free to contact us at any time.
Beautifully said, Yuri. And again, I'm always grateful to not only have Tama sponsoring these panels, but having you here firsthand, giving your insights, giving your feedback. It helps tremendously to have someone kind of on the inside, as it were, giving some of this feedback. So thank you again for that. Thanks again, everybody, for hanging out with us for the last hour and some change. And thanks again to Tama for making this panel possible. Have a great rest of your day, everybody.